And now, it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's speakers. Author Maura Weigel, PhD, who has written A Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating, and our moderator for this evening, Amanda Bradford, CEO and founder of dating app The League. Welcome them to the Inforum stage.
All right. Hi, everyone.
The mic's on now, right? We were assured it was off earlier when we were in the green room.
It was, which was good. I wanted to first introduce Maura Weigel, who's born in Brooklyn. As she said, her writing has appeared in everything from The Guardian to The New Nation, The New Republic, The New Inquiry. She's currently completing a PhD in comparative literature at Yale. After years of first-person research on dating, that's what I like to call it, first-person research. She's now off the market, sadly. I already tried to recruit her for my app backstage, but I got her to swear she's going to recommend The League to any single friend. So I did as much as I could. So I just personally finished reading her book, and it's called The Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. It's awesome. There's so many insights. She draws parallels about pretty much everything from looking at dating like an investment to a job to even prostitution. So it's, you know, the chapters are pretty varied, and it definitely gets you thinking. So I'd love to just talk to her a little bit today to get her insights and go a little bit deeper on some of those chapters. But before we get started, I want to do a quick poll just so we understand the kind of variety of experiences we have here in the audience. So I wanted to see if you guys wouldn't mind raising your hand if anyone's been on an online date. Look at this. This is good. This is actually good. 2 years ago in business school, they asked us that, and not one female raised her hand. So I'm proud that the stigma is lessening. The other question I wanted to ask is, how many of you have ghosted someone that you met on a dating app? All right. Come on. Okay. I think Cosmo came up with a stat that it's like 80%, so. So obviously the rules of dating are not quite defined, especially for our generation. We're actually both the same age, we're 31, so we're in an interesting time. I like to call it the coming of age of millennials and dating and relationships. So I wanted to first just start off with asking you kind of how you came up with the idea for the book. Why do you say that dating is like a job? And I'd love to just hear more about the inspiration behind it.
Totally. I wanted to ask, no one here's on a date.
Are they? Yeah, raise your hand if you're on a date right now. That's good to know.
Come on, no one? Yes,
all right.
Julie.
All right, yeah.
My partner, I think we're on a date, maybe. We're always on a date, that's what he says. How I got the idea for the book. I got the idea for the book a few years ago. I think it was the year 2012, when within a period of 6 months, there was a book called The End of Men. There was a book called The End of Sex. The New York Times ran an article called The End of Courtship. And I sort of started to notice these trends pieces that were saying, you know, men are over, romance is over, love is over, et cetera, et cetera. And I felt, both as a not yet partnered person and as...
So you were single at the time of writing.
Yeah! I wasn't married.
Another thing of our generation.
But also, more importantly, as a historian who's trained to be sort of like skeptical about enormous sweeping claims like men are over or sex is over, I sort of got curious about this whole trend, like where these trends pieces were coming from. And I didn't quite buy it. And I started, funnily, you know, I'm sorry to say, despite my love doctor coat, I don't have like a dating advice expert. I wasn't originally. That wasn't why I came to the topic. I got interested in dating because I felt like it was this place where people rehearse their gender roles. Like, it's like this sort of theater where we perform these ways we're supposed to be. And so this sense of like anxiety and crisis and dating is over that I was seeing everywhere, I got really curious about that. And then as soon as I started researching, I discovered this funny thing, which is that ever since dating was invented, which I say happened in 1896. I could say more about that. experts have constantly said that it's ending. Every single generation says, you know, this generation is dating wrong, or the younger people say, we're doing it wrong, our parents had it all figured out, everything is terrible, gender roles are in trouble. And so I was like, it's interesting. I hope that's comforting. I hope that's not like super depressing. I hope that's like a little bit comforting that everyone has been saying this for like 100 years. And right. I got interested in why that was. So that's a long roundabout way of saying that's sort of how I came to my interest in the book. It was precisely in response to this question, not is dating dead, but like, why are we always so fixated
right.
on that question, or why does everyone always feel anxious and in crisis about it?
And then what was your first step in figuring out how do you decide if it was indeed in crisis?
Well, I guess the way I'd answer that question, like, again, as a historian, even though I'm also masquerading as a dating expert, I think I can give you historical dating advice that I promise works. But I think, you know, I started looking at, well, why are the reasons that people say this? And again, it's often because the experts say, you know, men aren't being like men, women aren't being like women, you know,
right. Forget
any man who might want to date a man or women who might want to date a woman, that comes up also in the book. But there's sort of like this intensely normative set of roles that are getting hammered home through this discourse of crisis. So it's like, you know, when they say now the end of men and that sex is over, it means that young people are behaving differently
right.
than they used to. So anyway, I think that was what I discovered in terms of like why the ongoing crisis. And that, I mean, I guess in a much more straightforward answer to the question, I would say like, no, men are not over. Sex is not over. No, you can tweet that. Whoever's live tweeting that. But yeah, that was sort of what I drew from that historical pattern.
It was one of the questions I run a dating app and we get to hear the questions that people write in. We have a concierge. And so we get to, you know, we'll kind of file the ones that occur again and again. And this concept of should the guy pay on the first date seems to come up again and again, even when, you know, these women are making six figures, maybe even more than the guy they're going out with. And it just seems, you know, goes right into what you're saying about these like normative gender roles. And so I think one of the questions I had for you was on your first chapter, I think it was, where a big thesis in your book was focused on the ways people date change with the economy.
Yeah.
And I think I wanted to read a little chapter from this, which is, you know, in the past, women dated because it was how they could take part in leisure activities that they could not afford with their meager paychecks because they were getting paid, you know, less than 50% of what men were. In order to gain access to restaurants, movie theaters, amusement parks, many other new consumer services, they had to attract and please men who enjoyed higher earning power. Thus, they provided a service that men in turn paid for. And so that's sort of the history of the guy paying for the dinner or the first drink. And so I wanted you to just talk a little bit more about that, both, like, I guess from a historical perspective and then maybe drawing it to today.
Yeah, totally. One of the reasons I called the book Labor of Love is that it's secretly an economic history, don't tell anyone. But really what I call the invention of dating, sort of the rise of this form of courtship, which if you think about it is really weird, like most human societies and most times and places have not had this idea that how a person should meet his or her partner is going out in public and meeting a stranger and doing some fun things. In most times and places, courtship, bless you, has been controlled by family and community and authority figures like priests or rabbis. So this idea that how people should meet up and fall in love or find someone to have sex with or, you know, whatever dating is for, happens the way it does now, that really starts when women entered the paid workforce. And that sounds weird, maybe. It was not a thing I had thought about until I started my research, but it actually makes total sense that in every other society, in every other time period, women have stayed in the home for the most part, and how they meet men has been controlled. So, in a very literal way, the reason that this custom of like men paying for drinks or dinner or, you know, boardwalk tickets back in 1900 developed was because the first women who entered the workforce were working class women. They were poor women. As you mentioned, they made less than 50% of what men made. And these first women who moved to cities and take jobs in the 1890s quite literally can't afford a hot meal often. I read all these diaries of women who sort of move sometimes between sex work and sort of straight dating, talking about how, you know, if they didn't let men take them out, they'd never get a hot meal, much less a movie ticket. So that comes very directly out of the history of structural inequality of women, you know, both women's advance into the workplace, but also these persistent forms of gender discrimination and inequality, which still exist today. So I love to say it's just wage redistribution to let a man buy you a drink. It's just that, you know, the 23 cents or whatever it is you're still waiting for in the dollar. I'm not ideological about paying, you know.
Well, that was my next question is, how do you think about it in the framework of today? Is it wage distribution, redistribution, I guess, or is it, you know, another argument could be, you know, a guy buying you a drink is really showing his intent and he really likes you and he, you know, that sort of money, you're putting your money where your mouth is. So that, you know, girl could do the same thing, right? Could say, I really like you. I'm going to buy you a drink. I'm going to buy you boardwalk tickets. I guess, how do you parlay that into today's culture?
I don't think my husband ever took me to the boardwalk. You guys should watch movies from like the 19-teens and 20s. The boardwalk was wild. I think that it's complicated. I mean, I'm not just joking when I say this thing about wage redistribution. I think that the sense that it's, you know, and again, your app and your business deals with like fairly elite women. Maybe these kinds of overall gender dynamics that prevail nationally don't prevail there. But I think that we can't get around those problems of like continued structural inequality. As for who pays on a date or not, I do think it can be a way for someone of any gender to sort of signify intention or interest. It's hard to get out. One problem that I encountered writing this history is it's sort of toggling between the personal and sort of the structural, these scripts that we all inherit. And so while we might think that someone paying for someone else shouldn't signal intention or shouldn't matter so much, it does, because that's a script you've inherited.
Right.
So I think that, you know, we each have to find our way, and it depends on each person's situation to deal with that.
Do you think we need to be better about reframing or re-educating women on what to expect and not, you know, I guess you're saying they kind of inherit these scripts. So why are they inheriting these scripts? And is that something we need to work to change as a society?
Definitely. I mean, I think it's hard to say what any individual person does to change a social script, but I definitely think we do. I think they are changing for what it's worth. I mean, I think there are all sorts of indicators that when you look at people younger than we are, since you've given away our age this entire room, that there is, more fluidity and flexibility in gender roles, like by different standards, same with sexual orientation in different ways. So I think that maybe some of these roles are changing, but I definitely think it's an ongoing process. Who the we is, who has to re-educate people, I don't know. I think it's like a gradual society-wide kind of process.
And do you feel like you mentioned, like our app is, you know, we're only in New York and San Francisco, so I always say like we're living in the future. I like to think that we're on the, you know, the trailblazers and that everyone else is going to be kind of catching up? Or do you think that there'll always be this sort of niche elite group of people that might be really progressive, but the rest of America is going to continue in their traditional, you know, normative gender roles where, you know, the woman does the housework and raises the kids and the man needs to support her. And that's the sort of relationship that our parents had.
It's interesting. That does happen to be the kind of relationship my parents had. I think that most of the data on this suggests that there's actually a really dramatic split in America now between folks who went to college and folks who didn't. And it's, I mean, in terms of traditional gender roles, they're actually breaking down much faster among lower income groups in terms of marriage and how that relates to breadwinning and sort of income levels. I think there are a lot of stats that suggest, I mean, it's not even that suggest, I'll go ahead and say that it's definitely true that sort of members of the working, what we might call the working class, people who do not have college degrees are getting married at much lower rates. Women are supporting themselves and their children and not marrying at much higher rates. I think that's not necessarily desirable. I think that's a reflection of an economic reality where men in that income bracket have been very disempowered by different kinds of economic change since like the 70s or the 80s, which is when those numbers start to shift. In higher income brackets or among college educated folks, it's funny, there's a lot of data that suggests people are marrying older. I mean, the median age of first marriage for women now, I believe, is 27 and 29 for men in America, but they're actually staying married and by some measures continuing to have a more sort of traditional kind of marriage than we see among working class folks. So I'm not sure how the sort of coastal cities versus the rest of the country maps onto what we're calling like progressive versus not progressive. But unfortunately, I do think that bifurcation will continue to see. Happy Trump for President Day.
Yeah,
everyone.
Exactly. I guess you can see it in the election, right?
I was nervous about this event, and I was like, if they weren't here, they would be watching the RNC. Like, it's definitely going to be better than that. Anyway.
That's good. That's how we should market this event. So in your book, you've referenced the term sexual freelancing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have you educate everyone on what that term is and, I guess, what kind of things it describes.
I suspect certain people in this room know about sexual freelancing. The other big argument, so my book's called Labor of Love. Part of why I called it that was because it's a history of women in the workforce. Another part of why is because, like, a big part of my argument is that the ways people court one another changes historically with the economy. Now, I would say, you know, just to be playful, I'd say, you know, the 50s, the era of full employment, of everyone having one job for their whole lives, is also the era of people going steady and having one boyfriend or girlfriend who they identify with for long periods of time. I think the influence of the economy in our romantic lives is both practical. I mean, the kinds of things I was just talking about with class bifurcation or women needing money to go out and not having it. There's some very practical, like literal ways that the economy influences dating. But it's also sort of like spiritual or psychological in terms of what we think is valuable or what makes someone we would value in a person. And in that sense, I think that we do see this pattern. I try to trace it through the decades where what people think makes sense for courtship often resembles what they think makes sense in economic life. I always laugh because I teach college students, or I have taught college students at Yale, and, you know, there's a lot of panic about, like, hookup culture and casual sex and this kind of thing, and I look at these young people who are being told constantly by the authorities in their lives, like, you'll never have one job and don't expect to have a straight, you know, permanent gig with anything. And you have to be flexible. You have to be adaptable. Always keep your eyes open for the next opportunity. And then they look at them and they're like, why are you hooking up? And I'm like, well, it's the exact same set of values. You know, they're like, why aren't you committing to one partner? And it's like, well, and so anyway, that's a roundabout way of saying that I think, you know, in direct material ways, like Tinder is an Uber for sex. Like, that's what it is, or like a Seamless, maybe. Okay, I'm so embarrassed. My parents-in-law are in the room. Oh, you're so glad you were. They do know. They read the book.
Anyway, they're hip.
They're very hip. But it's like, you know, Tinder is an Uber for sex. OkCupid is kind of like a LinkedIn. I hope no one here works for OkCupid. I feel like OkCupid feels like LinkedIn. It just feels like kind of annoying. And it's like always asking you to update your profile in this kind of like try-hard way. So I think what I'm saying is that both in a literal practical way in terms of the platforms that we have available, and then also in this more intangible way in terms of how we think people should be, these kinds of economic and technological change how we court. And to that extent, I mean, what I literally mean by a sexual freelancer is like the person who's being chill on Tinder or OkCupid and has various partners and isn't sure. You know, just like isn't quite sure if they're not sure about whether or not they want to commit. But I think that it's, at the same time, I say this as a joke. I also, it's fun, I heard there were interns of yours. I always say dating is like an unpaid internship.
We pay ours.
Good for you. I was always thinking you might get a free lunch. That shows my age. You're supposed to pay the interns now. Sexual freelancing is this mode of dating that prevails in like our current moment of permalancing and, you know, nothing being permanent and everyone being ready supposedly to move or change positions, so, you know, to optimize themselves at a moment's notice. And I think we see that with relationships too.
Do you think so if we take your Uber for sex example, I won't rename the dating app, but so taking that a step further, I guess, do you think
yours is like Uber, which is I never take that expensive fancy Uber, which is like Uber black car, like Uber XL. It's like Tinder is like the Lyft line for sex, and yours is that.
That should be tweeted. We should tweet that one.
Someone, will you tweet that? Yeah. My husband's on it. You can tweet it.
So let's take that a step further. So let's say, you know, we're all Ubering every day. So by association, do you feel like the sort of the prevalence of maybe, or the ease of casual sex now is disrupting the traditional relationships? Are people having less real relationships? Are people realizing different things that, hey, maybe my sexual needs are taken care of by my Uber? And, you know, now I can focus on work, and like the kind of traditional partner is less necessary.
Maybe for certain people. I mean, I think I'm always hesitant to put the label real or not real on a relationship. I think that it's like, you know, you have a relation. We are in relation to one. Like, you have a relationship with many different people. You can have many kinds of relationships. And lest I seem like I'm being techno, like pessimistic or something, God forbid, in San Francisco at the Inn Forum, that, you know, internet dating, online dating apps are a godsend for so many people, you know, whether it's like queer kids not in New York and San Francisco, or like differently abled people, or like a divorced mom who's like 45 who doesn't have time to find someone. So I think that, you know, convenience factor, right, or whatever you want to call it, of the internet of apps is like life-saving for many people. And I don't mean, you know, I'm joking about like the expensive kind of Uber that I still don't know the name of, but it's a great thing. XL is the fancy one, right? Thank you. Who said that? Yeah. So I think they can be a great thing. I do think that a future that frightens me, or a thing that I find not desirable, is the way in which, you know, these apps, many apps, I'm sure not your app, many apps are like designed to make you believe that you could make everything efficient or do it in this sort of like on-demand way. And I don't think relationships work like that, nor do I think it is desirable necessarily to like make one's personal life efficient. Like, I don't think our personal lives are something we should have to like get done with as fast as possible. So I feel a bit like divided on that question, to be honest. I think that it, like, that flexibility could be extremely positive for many people and has been. And then on the other hand, it can also be the kind of flexibility that, you know, the driver of the Uber XL experiences, which is not always desirable.
Should we take a moment and understand how you met your significant other? Was it not on a dating app?
It wasn't. Oh, gosh. Yeah, we're so old. We met in the real world.
And was there traditional courtship at play?
You think so? Yeah, I mean, we went to college together. We didn't actually know each other in college. We actually sat next to each other in an intermediate German class that met at 9 a.m. And I think we like had a lot of conversations about like, did you go to the discotheque? It's like, what if we were to go to the discotheque? I went to the discotheque. But we never really hung out outside of that. He was kind of punk rock at that time. He still has cooler looking friends who are here in the audience. And then we re-met 8 years later at a party. I was about to go to China for 4 months on fellowship. I think it was the best long game ever. I was like, you seem great. I'm going to China for 4 months. I played it really cool. And then we got together and we got back. So we have a pretty, I don't want to say conventional because I don't think there is any one convention, but not a terribly scandalous story. We did not meet in the back of a Lyft line, alas.
All right, so one of my other questions was around, so one of my focus areas is like working women. We have a lot of career-oriented, ambitious women on our app. You wrote something that I thought was interesting, which was when women first hit the workforce, the belief remained widespread that they were working not to support themselves, but only to supplement the earnings of fathers or husbands. As such, this is sort of the genesis of the wage gap that we all still talk about. I have a Google alert for gender pay gap, and there's like 10 articles a day on it. And so I guess my question is, do you think this has been eradicated now at the corporate level? And also then, I guess, taking it a step further at the relationship level.
Well, wage inequality definitely hasn't been eradicated in the workplace. I mean, I think there's lots of good data.
You said the widespread belief. The belief remained widespread that they were working not to support themselves, but to supplement.
Yeah, it's interesting. I imagine that has most, I mean, I think that it's like this great irony of, you know, the way we talk about like, well, should a woman work, or the choice to work? And it's like almost all people have to work. This isn't a choice for most people. Not that I'm saying you're
especially
saying that.
Especially living in San Francisco.
Yes. But so I feel like probably there is, I would imagine, like a pretty widespread understanding that most women have to work and that it's not like just to supplement an income. Although I do think, again, if you have the Google alert, you probably have more up-to-date news than I do. But I do think there is still an assumption among many groups that it's like a woman's career will take the back seat, that, you know, there's all these horrifying statistics in my field, academia, about how being married as a male professor like increases your likelihood of tenure, but if you're a female professor, marriage like decreases it, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
The most horrifying datum is not relevant to dating, but I'll tell you afterwards. So I think that that particular assumption probably had nobody, or I would imagine few people consciously hold that belief anymore. I imagine it still unconsciously has certain effects. Right. And how we view either traditionally feminine professions or how we view, you know, women who we assume will play certain roles in the family or whatever. In terms of relationships, there is a funny way in which I think people who are quite progressive or aggressive or go-getting in their professional lives feel more traditional or more sort of confined to a certain kind of stereotypically feminine gender role. Did I say that right? In their personal lives. It's like the workbook is lean in. It's like the dating book is like the rules. He hates you. He's just not that into you.
Right.
That's what I was trying to say. I think that
the
in
two
their
Bibles, right? Yeah.
Well, really, seriously, if you just like walk through the advice aisle, the ones for jobs are like brag, ask for it, like lean in. And the,
for dating, it's
for
like,
straight
don't
women,
call him back. Yeah.
It's literally like he's not that into you. It's not him. It's you. It's just like. The rules, hopefully no one reads the rules anymore from the 90s, although I recently got trolled. I hope they're watching. I recently got trolled by the rules authors and their fans on the internet. So they still exist. But the rules is this Bible of like dozens of things that you're not supposed to do. And so I do think that this idea that a certain class of women are pushed to show agency and aggression in the workplace and yet told constantly that they have to hide those very characteristics in their personal lives. That's still true. Fascinatingly, it's been that way since like the 20s. That advice in terms of whatever you want to do, like do the opposite of that. It's like, do you want to ask a guy out? Don't do it. It's like, do you want to have sex? Don't do it. Did you have sex with him? Don't call him. It's like the rules. Rule number 32 is don't break the rules. It's like this crazy cultic system. I think that I'm serious. I think that high achieving women who would never accept that kind of frank sexism in their professional lives sometimes do internalize it and act on it in their personal lives.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you've said do you find that on the app?
Yeah, no, we've seen, it's been interesting to see very high achieving women that are worried about messaging first because they think that that will make them look. Actually, one woman wrote, I'll never forget this. I think it was like a 9-page email to us because our concierge encourages whoever is the second match to make the move, regardless of gender. And she wrote a 9-page response to me personally about why we shouldn't be encouraging women to message first. And that studies show that actually women are less desirable as seen through like ancient prehistoric animalistic data that, you know, women should be chaste. And it was like, it was the most incredible email.
I had this about the prehistoric. I just moved here from New York. People are so upset. Sorry, that's, I shouldn't, but the whole prehistoric thing is so weird. And all these EvPsych articles that are like, cave people were this way, so you too must date this way. I have done research on some of the science behind that. I don't need to get into it right now. Be very skeptical of those articles that are like, evolutionary science proves it's like conventionally attractive people are attractive. And it's like because some study showed it. So anyway, everyone clicks that clickbait. I do it too. It's okay. But I think that like these claims are highly dubious. And actually it's funny. People sometimes ask me like, what's the most surprising thing you found? And one factoid I love is that advice mavens of like the 1900s, you know, around 1900, thought that it was always up to a woman to like guide the romantic interaction, because when a young man, so before dating, you have like calling, which is the sort of Jane Austen-y type scenario.
You have a dance card, right?
You do. Well,
I was excited about that.
Yeah,
that
or a calling
fun.
Card. Yeah, definitely. Ooh, I just thought of something. Anyway, I have a startup idea.
You came to the right place.
What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So I found these advice articles where young men, there was a woman who was a columnist for the Ladies' Home Journal, which is the highest circulation magazine in the world in 1900. And there's a columnist called the Lady from Philadelphia who asks people's answers questions about how to behave. And she got multiple letters from young men saying, I really like this woman, but she hasn't asked me to call on her. Can I, like, make the first move? And the lady from Philadelphia says, you would do nothing but invoke her just displeasure by doing so if you haven't been invited. So I think my point, she also says a young woman named Sadie wrote to the lady from Philadelphia in 1905 and asked, what should I do if a suitor continues to hold my hand in spite of all that I can say? And the lady from Philadelphia says, no gentleman who is worthy of your company would continue to hold your hand if you asked him to stop like you really meant it. My point is that these ideas that I feel like you get sort of clickbaity journalism, yeah. That are like, oh, ever since the cave people, it's been the same until now. And like, therefore, women should act like they acted in the 1950s. It's like this one period that we've frozen in our head as prehistory. It's not true. I mean, that was part of why I wanted to write a history of this, too, is I think we inherit a lot of ideas.
Like recent history, but not the actual full history.
Yeah, well, the full history, I say dating as I take it as a very specific social practice that has to do, you know, people don't call it dating. And before about 1900, the date is like when you pick a time to meet someone. That's where the word comes from. It's like, we'll meet at this date. And that only happens once women get to walk out of the Jane Austen-y parlor. And the downside is that then the dude who has more money invites you instead of it being up to you and your mom to invite him. I think there are advantages and disadvantages to both ways. But I can't remember why I'm saying all that. But this idea that it's like men have always been the aggressors and women are naturally passive, it's just not substantiated by either science or history.
I'll have you write my response to that lady.
I thought, as an intern, I feel like one of these interns and I could do it.
Yeah.
We'll do it after.
I guess to focus on the men a little bit, like what role do they play? Because I think we talk about we're told, like you kind of mentioned it earlier, like who is this we? Is it the media? Is it our households? Is it the stories we read? Is it the television we watch? And our men, I guess, what role do they play in kind of encouraging these somewhat antiquated stereotypes?
I actually believe that these kinds of roles, these sort of quote-unquote traditional gender roles, are bad for men as well as women. I mean, I think that from the moment women enter the workforce, from the moment they gain the liberty to not have to wait in their mom's parlor for someone to come call on them, they're told relentlessly to play this game of hard to get or that they have to withhold. 20s advice is all about that. I could say more about that. But I think that that's hard on women for all the reasons we were talking about, like the rules being like, don't tell your therapist about the rules, don't call him, don't answer a text message. I mean, that's hard on women because women are told constantly to repress their instincts and their agency. It's hard for men, too, I think. I mean, I think this idea that, like, any heterosexual relationship, like, the sole responsibility for how it will progress is on the dude, that's a lot of pressure, and it doesn't correspond to reality, and I think people sense that. So I think that a lot of men would just as soon leave behind these outdated gender roles, too. I have a whole theory of this and Judd Apatow, but we can talk about that in questions. The sort of man-child schlub is the fantasy of escape from this gender role. But
wait, can you describe that a little more? That just went over my head.
This is so, oh no, I'm getting off topic.
It's okay, we were told we were allowed to go off topic.
It's true. I feel like there are so many movies in the past 10 years where there's a couple. I joke about this. I have an article I'm doing for The Atlantic about this. Comedies of Unplanned Pregnancy is what it's about, which is what the new Bridget Jones movie. But this is, I'm so sorry. I don't think I should be talking about this. But I feel like we see a whole genre of romantic comedies in the past 10 years where the plot is like this really high-achieving, really together type A woman who like has all her shit together, and then there's like this schlubby, losery man who you know, this woman, I'm thinking of Knocked Up because I feel like that's sort of like the classic of this category. my parents-in-law. Sorry, I have to look back this way. Yeah, so this couple would never get together. And then how they get together is by some totally implausible twist of fate. The woman gets pregnant and, like, doesn't have an abortion for some totally implausible and inexplicable reason and decides to get together. It's true. In that movie, there's no indication of her being religious or having... There's no reason why that... I'd never believe that that character would have Seth Rogen's baby. But anyway. The point is that there are a lot of movies like this. There's that movie with J-Lo. I forget what that's called. The Backup Plan. They were going to call it Plan B, but they didn't realize that's the name of a morning after contraceptive, and then they changed it. There's a movie with Lindsay Lohan about this. There's that plotline in Sex and the City that's about this. There's the new Bridget Jones movies about this. I feel like we see story after story that's like, there's actually no hope for heterosexuality and its current configuration other than this, like, accidental pregnancy that somehow makes this, like, high-achieving woman shut up and loosen up and this, like, loser schlubby man get his act together. This is a really depressing pattern for the love story, I think. Why I'm saying all this is that I actually do believe, I mean, this is just like a total tangent, and I can't believe I just went on it in front of all of you, but I really do believe that these gender roles that are like, oh, a man should always take initiative and a woman should always be passive, nobody wants them, and this whole sort of like, that whole script doesn't actually make any sense. I think that there's a lot of discomfort with it. There's need to move beyond it. So all that to say, in terms of like what we can do or what people can do, I think that straight men, many straight men would like love to move beyond these narratives too.
So we just have to empower them.
I think they're pretty powerful.
This is where I tell you to download my app. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah, yeah, download her app. It's the Uber XL of dating apps.
Well, that actually brings me, so you mentioned, you talked about getting knocked up. So that brings me to a little bit in your book, you talk about pushing out kind of the ticking clock and the woman who's dating with the clock ticking and the concept of settling due to biological reasons, not necessarily due to desire. So I'd love to hear a little bit about, I guess, your thoughts on this kind of new rage of egg freezing. We actually, my company, I am planning to freeze my own eggs. And so we held a egg freezing mixer last night. I know. It would have been more fun with guys, but it was still fun. So we held an egg freezing mixer, but it was crazy. We had a 300 person wait list to come. Like, this is a topic that women in their 30s really want to learn about, and we're not ready. A lot of us aren't ready to have kids right now. And so I'd love to hear, I guess, how you think that plays into dating and how that's changed in across history since you've researched it.
Yeah, totally. One thing that really interested me when I was doing my research for this book was I was reading all these relationship advice books from older periods, watching movies, looking at different kinds of cultural texts that I think we get our messages from. Actually, I'll pick one out that maybe people will have seen. I remember there's this moment in When Harry Met Sally, when Sally's sitting at the boathouse, like, with her friends, and I forget why she even says this, but she says, you know, the clock doesn't really start ticking till you're 36. And I was like, 36? Like, I feel like there, and again, there's different studies and data about this, but that young women become anxious about their fertility at much younger ages than that now. And it struck me that in the advice books, or sort of case study type books from earlier periods, there wasn't this emphasis on age and this idea that, you know, a woman has to get her life together, you have to be on this track. And that interested me. And so I sort of started looking into the history of this idea of the biological clock and the idea that women have one and men don't, which isn't true. Tweet that, someone.
That's a sweeping statement. Women don't have a biological clock.
No. The idea that men don't have, that male fertility is not affected by aging, is not true. Everyone has, humans have biological clocks.
I was like,
clocks.
That's a new one. Okay.
And they're aging right now. TikTok. But But one of the single most shocks, so I got really interested in this idea of like the history of the biological clock. When did everyone start to talk about that? So it turned out that that phrase, the biological clock, actually historically it was used to refer to circadian rhythms, like when people wake and sleep and eat and stuff. It starts getting used to mean fertility the way we use it now. In the late 70s, the phrase is coined by Richard Cohen in an article that I secretly suspect is about Nora Ephron, but I can't prove that claim. But about this idea of like career women, women who were boomers who'd entered the workforce, had had access to the pill, were able to put off childbearing for various reasons, were suddenly freaking out about their fertility. So that's, anyway, that's an idea that really takes off in the 80s. And I think that there are some unignorable reasons for it, because all bodies age in time. It is true that this population that is now staying in the workforce now has more opportunities, at least in certain income brackets, faces certain kinds of pressures. On the other hand, the construction of fertility, the widespread idea that only women affect fertility, is completely false. I encourage whoever is live tweeting to Google like male biological clock and sperm photos. One of the most shocking things I learned, other than that thing about the lady from Philadelphia who tells that young man that he can't call on the woman without invoking her just displeasure, one of the most surprising things I learned in all of my research was that the most recent data of the ASRM, stands for American Society for Reproductive Medicine, of fertility doctors in the United States. Their most recent data shows that for couples that go to fertility doctors because they're having trouble conceiving, wait for it, 40% of the time it's found to be female factor. So 40% of the time it's the woman's fault. 40% of the time it's male factor, 20% of the time they can't tell. So it is literally known to be equal amount of the time, male factor and female factor. I feel like, again, women and men's bodies don't age in exactly the same way. There are differences. Ovarian reserve works differently than sperm count. But the idea that only women have to worry about fertility and planning their lives and balancing the personal and the professional, that is pure ideology.
So you want us to have a sperm mixer?
Yeah. It's funny because the sad things, three sad things happen to sperm as you get old. I'm so sorry. The decrease in number. In fact, there's a new app, or like a, not an app, a sperm counter, an at-home sperm counter that's just launched called Track. And you can measure your sperm count at home. Seriously, guys. You can like just put the, I think they say specimen, whatever the polite way they say it is. You put it in a little cup and you pour it in this little centrifuge and it goes woo. And then, it measures your sperm count right then and there. Sperm count decreases with age.
Perfect for the mixer. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a quite literal mixer. They sent me the information for the Track and it says, be sure to seal the cap. And it's just like, it's like a high-speed centrifuge. Oh my God. Be sure to seal the cap when you do that mixture. Male sperm count decreases, sperm morphology changes, and sperm motility declines. That is why, again, literally equal percentages of the time infertility problems are caused by male and women and women. Again, I'm not saying that there's no difference at all, but this idea that only women have to worry about a biological clock is a fiction, and it's the same reason I think that we think only women have to worry about work-life balance, where it's like, if you have equal partners in life, both of them should be worried about work-life balance. But
all right, we're going to be doing Q&A in 5 minutes, so start thinking of a clever question that ends with a question mark and doesn't involve a lot of personal information.
I love it when it gets personal.
I know. Apparently they've had some interesting history here.
Really?
So you line up over there, and we'll do that in 5 minutes. So then the other, I guess, one last thing just about kind of motherhood and family. In your book, you talk about, actually you had an interesting quote here about family and marriage, and you said, women came to believe that raising children and taking care of a husband were instinctual, as if it was simply in their natures to do anything for love. I'd love to hear, I guess, some of the research that you found that made you not feel like it's instinctual or is it instinctual for men and women? Or I guess just getting a little bit more clarity on how you believe that, that, I guess, how do you support that claim?
Yeah, I think that that, if I'm remembering, and it's been a little while since I wrote the book, but if I'm remembering where that comes from, I was trying to talk about this idea that's very deeply entrenched in our culture about what's work and what isn't. The idea, if you had told a farmer, I'm told by people at startups that when you want to work at a startup or maybe a big tech company, they ask you, like, explain the internet to a medieval farmer. So if you told that medieval farmer that what men do is work and what women do isn't work, that would have sounded crazy. If you had said, you, man, who go and, like, plow the field and take your, like, crops to the farm, to the fair, to sell it, that's work. And it's like the shit your the stuff your wife does, like killing the chickens and, you know, going in labor to have your kids and raising them and making dinner, that's not work. That would have seemed crazy. The idea that, like, traditionally female tasks are not work and traditionally male tasks are work is actually a pretty historically new idea, and I could get more into that. So in that specific place, I think I was talking about the ways in which for various reasons, what women do in the home has become to seem like not work. So, like, taking care of kids is not work. Having kids is not work. These are not things anyone deserves recognition or remuneration for. That's a historical idea, too. I think, you know, how it plays out, again, this is, like, a complicated and big question. Maybe we can get into the Q&A. I'm interested in how it plays out in, like, do what you love culture, where now we're supposed to not differentiate between our what we love and what we're paid for, which in practice seems to mean everyone works all the time. I think that specific passage, I was talking about the rise of this idea that, like, men and women live in different worlds and that what the men do is work and what the women do isn't work, which is actually only, like, a 200-year-old idea, but... more on that. More on that later, I think.
Okay, cool. So a couple questions just to wrap up before we do the Q&A. So you said in an article that you came to feminism late. I'd love to hear, I guess, why that was and how you, I guess, would you call yourself a feminist? And then if you do, when that happened to you?
Yeah, I would definitely.
It's like hitting puberty, I guess.
Yeah, it is. That's kind of nice, actually. I like that. I'm definitely a feminist. I definitely believe in the political and economic and the social equality of women of all genders. I think coming to feminism late, this is a thing we talked about a little bit right before coming up here. I feel like until I was, like, in my early mid-20s, it just never occurred to me to be interested in feminism. It didn't seem like it was a thing that was about me or relevant to me. I think probably part of that is because I grew up in the 90s. It's like this supposedly post-problem world where it's like, you know, everyone has equality of opportunity. We'll all go do our thing. The Feminine Mystique, those books were part of history. I think probably part of it is that as you grow up, you realize that stats like things about wage inequality or, you know, whatever these different things are going to, they do apply. They do apply to you. I think that it took me a while because of that. I do also think we're living, and maybe, again, this is, like, a nice thing to open out into in Q&A. I think we're actually living in this really exciting moment of, like, a revival of American feminism, which I think was sort of dormant and not in a particularly interesting way for a couple decades. I don't know how many decades, but I think, you know, I grew up with Sex and the City in that era, and it just, like, is wearing Manalo Blahnik's feminist? And it's like, I don't know. What a stupid question. So I think that, no offense to anyone who ever asked that question. So I think that probably maybe part of it is about, like, the overall cultural mood. I mean, I think we live in this very contested, you know, everyone's fighting about what feminism is, but everyone is talking about it in a way they weren't even 5 years ago. I think probably part of it is growing up and realizing that all these things I thought I could somehow, like, overachieve my way out of did in fact apply to me. And I think that part of it is just gaining more self-awareness and growing up. And maybe the second two are sort of part of the same thing. I mean, how about you?
Yeah, I would say I think similar when you are very focused on kind of the path that people give you to go and achieve on. It's easy to just take it and run with it and not necessarily question it. So I think it's kind of like the politics your parents give you. I always say, took me till I was like mid-20s to be like, oh, my dad is completely wrong. And like everything he taught me, I totally disagree with. So, yeah. You know, you don't know that until you're 20s and you're in college and you're starting to question things. So I think feminism to me is kind of the same type of thing.
Yeah, the dads in the head are hard to shake.
Not that dads are wrong always, but some dads might be.
Hi, Dad.
No.
Hi, Dad. No. Don't listen to this podcast. So one more thing I wanted you to touch on, just because I thought it was interesting in your book. I don't really have a good question to prime it, but one was the speed dating little anecdote I thought was really funny, and then the other was talking about the free love, like dating in the free love culture when everyone was doing drugs and having communes and stuff. So I didn't know if you had any interesting anecdotes you wanted to pull from the book.
It's funny because San Francisco, maybe there are even some free lovers here, but I feel like just the, you know, San Francisco is a great historical site of free love and the summer of love. It's complicated. There's some nice things about it, some not so nice things about it. The speed dating anecdote, which I also love, is this. Speed dating was invented by an Orthodox Jewish rabbi named... Does anyone know this? Does anyone this old know? This is one... Yes, you do? Do you remember his name? No. His name was Yaakov Deo. Do you remember where he held the first speed dates?
No, I've just heard of this story before.
An Orthodox rabbi in Los Angeles was concerned that members of his synagogue were not meeting. The young people were not meeting and dating. And so he met up with some sort of showbiz type people who he also knew from his synagogue to talk about what they might do about this. And they came up with this idea of turning it into kind of a game. And so Rabbi Yaakov Deo got a bunch of people together at a Pete's Coffee in Beverly Hills and had them talk in 10-minute segments. And at the end of 10 minutes, he would wave the Gregor, like the thing that you use on Purim where you stomp and make noise. And then they would switch seats. I think the women sat still and the men would switch seats. And he did this a few times. It got so popular. There were so many people that he invented. He then started making like Excel spreadsheets of the different people. And then now I'm trying to remember, I don't even think I put this in the book, but some TV folks learned about it. And I think one of the first like local broadcast dating show, speed dating shows started in LA. But yeah, people have tried to make it efficient before Tinder. Unfortunately, Yaakov Deo just didn't know how to scale. Maybe some more mature folks in the audience could tell us about the Summer of Love in Q&A.
Well, the one story that stuck out to me was the guy that came back. He was like, oh, I'm free and I'm dating a bunch of, sleeping with a bunch of people. And then he came back to his older wife, who was like cooking him dinner and was talked. But anyway, basically, it was interesting because there was still like the takeaway that I thought was that there were still these normative gender roles, even in the Summer of Love. And even when they were kind of doing this very free sleeping around, and there was still, he returned home for dinner and cooking from his wife.
Yeah, that scene, they weren't even married. That scene is from Joan Didion's essay on the Summer of Love, and the dude's name was Max. I don't think he even says his girlfriend's name. But she tells this story about interviewing a young man who is behaving as you described. And she doesn't, Didion, in her sort of understated Joan Didion way, I think, doesn't really comment on it. Although she says Max's life was a triumph over don'ts. And I think so long as we think of like what sexual freedom is in terms of breaking rules or doing all these things, we do end up actually with this rather inequitable version, or a version that looks a lot more traditional. I mean, ironically, I think a lot of the young men, and maybe some of them are here and want to contradict me, probably not, who participated in the Summer of Love ended up ironically looking a lot like their Playboy reading fathers in a way. They were like living out this fantasy of easy promiscuity that they'd inherited from the 50s and maybe was less politically radical than you might think. I mean, the women, the memoirs and the interviews with the women who were there often certainly suggest that. I think it's Angela Davis who talks about being asked to stand by her man, and she says, and so the shit goes on. And that's in The Panthers. It doesn't get more radical than that in a lot of ways. So I think there's a tension between the radical sort of emancipatory politics of the 60s and the ways in which some of those, the most progressive folks by some measures, fall back into, again, traditional. Traditional is like the 50s,
right.
Gender roles.
Cool. Yeah, we can open it up for questions.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
This is more of a two-part question. I would love to hear your thoughts on just two things. One is a friend of mine and I were having this conversation about us living in this era of everything Insta, everything happening so fast, Insta deliver, Insta cook, whatever is delivered to you without you actually making an effort. In a way, not actually living that experience. The food's delivered directly to you without you actually going through the cooking, which is part of living by some standard. That same applies to dating, Insta dating. Everything kind of gets delivered to you by opening up a profile. Traditional dating, or more traditional, like offline, is you get to know you get to meet the person, get to know them. It takes a long time to get to know people. It's not immediate feeling. It takes a long time. So there's a contradiction there. And I'm just thinking, going forward, what's the next? Like VR? you just not even need to meet the person anymore, and you can simulate
cyber
the feeling.
There are definitely people working on that VR thing. Yeah. No, sorry.
We're living in this era of an interesting, segue into taking a long time to do something, actually living a human experience, to maybe eliminating some of that human experience, gaining time, but to do what else, right? So I would love to hear your thoughts on that one. I'm actually not from the U.S., and mm-hmm. dating in the U.S. is incredibly different from what I understood as relationship.
Where are you from?
I'm from China, mm-hmm. but it's a completely different world out there. And I'm sure for anybody dating internationally, cross-borderly, there's tons of challenges. I'd love to hear your research into that, if any.
Yeah, I'll answer the questions backwards. I've actually lived in China and have written about like Fei Chong Wurao and like the Chinese dating shows and sort of the rise of dating in China elsewhere. I decided not to put it in the book because I felt like, for two reasons. One is just practical, which is that like to write about everywhere would become an infinite book. The second one was that I really do think, in a way, dating and this courtship system, where we think that how we should find partners is like this weird mix of work and entertainment, where it's like you kind of have to work at it, but then like it also involves buying stuff, and like it, you know, nobody bought stuff to do courtship before the invention of dating. Think about that. That it's very American, and that it really is invented in America and sort of gets exported like Bachelor TV show knockoffs. I definitely think there are a lot of cross-cultural differences. I think dating patterns and sexual mores tend to follow economic patterns more than some sort of like absolute and abstract idea of culture. I think the case of China is very interesting. You would know more about it than I do. But I think that, you know, it's no accident that you didn't really talk about dating or have any kind of dating culture until relatively recently. You have China joins the WTO, you have this explosive period of economic growth, you have a lot of women moving to cities and taking jobs, and you start to have all these phenomenon of urban dating that actually do rather look there are differences, but superficially resembles what happens in the U.S. in a lot of ways. So I think that, just to circle back to sort of the thesis of the book, that it has to do with the economy, you actually see that in how it travels. I've done a lot of interviews and a lot of talks with people from Europe about the book, where people say, oh, there was never dating in Germany or the Netherlands or whatever, except until Tinder, and now we all date. I think that seriously, that it's like these technologies and sort of economic and social forms travel, and they do bring new practices with them. They also bring, this is too long an answer, but in China now there's, and in Korea and Japan, from what I understand, there's this whole discourse about like leftover women and this hysteria about women aging out of the dating force too. So it's funny, you see a lot of the same things in different places, actually, with certain kinds of economic and cultural change. To your first question about whether we're sort of like efficienting ourselves out of life or out of happiness, you know, whether being more efficient at everything is always more desirable, I think it's hard to say for every person. I mean, I think it depends on priorities and values. I have accepted that I'm garbage at cooking. I don't like it. I don't like chopping. I don't like washing. I am very happy to get takeout food and not experience the cooking part. I feel differently about, you know, sex and human connections and relationships. So I think that it's a matter of what we want to make efficient. I think that sometimes we start to treat love or relationships as if they're some kind of product, you know, there's something that you could be matched to with the perfect algorithm, and it's not, it's a process, you know, it's an experience. So I think that there are real limits to applying the logic of efficiency to love.
Hi, Moira. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for having us. So I had another question, but after that, this came up, which I think is perhaps even more interesting. So it sounds like the thesis of your book is that the fluctuations in the dating and, you know, the male-female marketplace have a lot to do with economic force and labor forces. But how about the sex ratio as a countervailing force? Because even right now, with this economic climate, stuff happens in New York that does not happen in San Francisco or L.A. based on the sex ratio. So how do you see that as a force that was modifying or maybe overwhelming the other trends?
Because you probably have observed this in real time in your app.
I think when guys talk about the sex ratio in San Francisco, it is 50-50, guys. Like, I know it's not quite New York. There are not quite as many girls in New York, but it's actually really equal now in San Francisco.
According to Richard, Florida, it's not, but okay.
But anyway, I mean, we see, yeah, I mean, obviously there are more women on our dating app than men in New York. In San Francisco, it's equal, but I don't know if you've done research into kind of how that affects dating customs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly does. It's funny because, as I said, I just moved here from New York and I'd read this book called Datanomics, where the man's advice is that all the sad single women in New York should move to San Jose because of the gender ratio. He calls it Man Jose. The first time I went to San Jose.
Might be right.
But I don't know. I think that it definitely has an effect. Oh, sorry. So the whole point of that was that then I moved here and I was like, girls, it must be so great to date here. And everyone was like, no, it's garbage. I've yet to go to the city where everyone's like, it's so great dating here.
The odds are good, but the goods are odd.
Oh, you all look so lovely. I'm sure no one's odd. I just want to give everyone a hug sometimes. Yeah, I think the gender ratio definitely has an effect. I think that it's less like immediately obvious how it affects it than you might think from the Man Jose dude. Yes, sir.
But you did talk about in the book when the men went to war and the women, they did get more like competitive with each other to try to land a man, right? So it does.
Yeah, definitely. It does. No, it definitely has effects. I think it's like they're not always as straightforward as you might think, but for sure.
So. Hi. Hello, I've really enjoyed this discussion so far.
Thank you.
Oh, and I'm quite sure it'll continue.
I like your shirt.
Oh, thanks.
His shirt says, "Men of quality do not fear equality."
That's good.
I just bought it. I didn't make it. So I guess I have a couple questions. At points of this discussion, I was reminded of Jane Addams.
Mm-hmm.
In early Chicago, she was basically caring for a lot of the women who had a really, really hard time finding a hot meal. And she had a book, 20 Years at Whole House, mm-hmm. which is very, very illuminating as to like what the world was back then. And also I was reminded of Victoria Woodhull mm-hmm. and her free love book back in the, like free love back in her day was a completely different thing than the free love in the 60s. And so basically what I'm wondering is I would love more reading material. I like the way you've... I've already bought your book, maybe like 20 minutes ago. So I'm very interested in more reading material about like, because I'm kind of an economics nerd. So if anything that like kind of like puts those two things together is very interesting to me. Also historically and also phenomenologically. So in other words, like something that would help me further step outside of my white male privilege and try to understand better what humanity is, because humanity is like 50% women. And so I'm basically, I'm very interested in more reading material, so I would love recommendations.
Yeah, you're doing good,
dude. What are you reading right now?
I actually have like a little essay in the back about other books that I recommend. And there's sort of a couple different genres of them, but Jane Addams actually does come up in the book in the first chapter, and she wrote a book that then was mine for research heavily for some early films that come up, so I would recommend some of that. There's in terms of history, there's a book by an academic. I mean, first, you should all buy and read my book. but there's a book by an academic called From the Front Porch to the Back Seat by a woman named Beth Bailey that's great, that talks. She wrote it in the 80s, so it's sort of like an older history. I think the other ones are probably the ones I talk about in the back, there's a lot of good, like, American studies, American history books about working women. Jane Merowitz is a great author on that. Kathy Pice. Again, I have the reading suggestions at the end, but thanks for your interest. It's a great topic.
And then we'll have to take two more questions.
Hi. Thank you for coming and speaking. My question is, you mentioned a lot about the gender roles and the dating roles. Are there any that you think are specifically harmful and that we should consciously be trying to buck?
Yeah, all of them. Like, I'd say all of them, yeah. I mean, I think, again, I really do believe that, like, a younger generation is evolving out of them. I feel so depressed about most things about the world right now, but I actually think on certain gender and sexuality issues, we're evolving in a really positive direction. I mean, I think, you know, I think that acknowledging all people as people, I mean, I don't, again, this is very abstract, as, like, people with sexual agency and desire that matters, I think taking women's sexual desire more seriously and sort of giving women ways to speak about it more openly is helpful. Yeah, I think that, honestly, just moving past this sort of binary paradigm where it's like women are passive, men are active, which I really do think is bad for everyone, that's the biggest thing. And that manifest, those roles, or rather those sort of core beliefs, manifest in all sorts of little ways. But yeah, I think that's the biggest thing.
Thank you.
Good evening, Moira and Amanda. I have a question. How much do you think this generation is missing out in terms of love, romance, and dating, because people stop looking at each other, they stop flirting with each other, they stop coming up to each other, they fully rely on apps, and also they even stop calling each other and asking each other out. How are you? What's up? How is your day?
I like that. No, I'm kidding. You go.
Someone walk up to this man and ask him on a date right now. I think that, you know, I'm sort of, I think there are goods and bads. As I was saying before, I think that you can really flirt over text message. I think text message and email can be wonderful media for flirtation. So I don't think that that the fact that we use apps or use, like, our phones to connect is necessarily a bad thing or precludes flirting and connection. I do think that this obsession with efficiency does tend to work against connection. So I think that, does that make sense? I think that there's also a way in which we get so addicted to these apps that are supposed to be like the means to the end that we end up spending quite a lot of time on this thing that's supposedly supposed to be efficient. I think that, you know, in that way, things that are supposed to be tools to a certain end up becoming like the main focus. You know, it's just like, oh, if I just put one more TV show in the TV shows I like, it's like I'll find Prince Charming. Actually, hot tip, if you add just like a comma to your LinkedIn profile at a high traffic time you like, it's as if you added a whole new taste. Anyway, yeah, so I think, like, yes, there are certain downsides. There are also really big upsides in some ways, as we were getting into before, so it's a back and forth. I think I would encourage everyone to, like, own their own time and own their own pleasure and realize that, like, it doesn't always have to be this matter of efficiency. And also, just because you don't get married to someone and, like, have babies with them doesn't mean that it was a waste of time. Like, our experiences are not a waste of time just because they don't lead down a certain path. So I think that's my response to that. Someone walk up to this man. Anyway,
yeah.
Thank you.
All right, great. Well, so our closing question, which is in forums, favorite question to ask is, in 60 seconds, what would you do to change the world?
I'm really upset because while we were talking, I figured out the answer to that because they warned me that they were going to ask me that. And now I'm just like, what was it? What was it? And I'm just remembering that sperm centrifuge.
I think it was that startup idea. Yeah.
Yeah. this is going to be a really abstract answer. I honestly think that this... No, but this is no good. Am I allowed to say, like, universal basic income? I mean, I think that... Yeah, there. I think that this, like, constant pressure... Again, I think that... And the book really gets into this, but I think that so many of the pressures and sources of unhappiness in our life that we think of as personal or personal failings are, in fact, structural and social. Like, that's what the book's really about. And so I think that,
universal basic income, paid leave for people of all genders, elimination of student debt, and what else? I can't, healthcare and childcare. I think that basically the way in which, like, this sort of ruthless logic of contemporary capitalism pushes people to work all the time, to sell themselves all the time, to feel that way when they're dating, to feel like you have to work harder to sell yourself faster at dating because everything feels so high stakes and precarious. I actually think that, funnily, those pressures are really connected to these big structural issues. So I'm going to go with universal basic income.
We'll take it. We'll take it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you did great. So Maura's going to be signing books down here right in the front row. So buy a book and get her autograph.
My lovely in-laws left, so I can tell you the juicy stuff.
Yeah,
now.
I think we scared them.
Yeah, they've heard it. They've heard it all before.
Yeah, so you guys come
Thank
here.
Thank you so much for coming, guys.